Well, to begin our class with a correction, which I'm thankful to Elizabeth Osteen for calling to my attention. I had mentioned, if you look back at chapter 2, verse 6, it talks about who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives, who had been exiled with Jeconiah. We had talked about who the who referred to. Anyway, we were talking about the age of Mordecai, and I think I said in class that you would date from 586. That's incorrect. You date from 597. That's when Jehoiakim or Jeconiah got several different names. But that's what chapter 2 and verse 6 is talking about, 597. There are three captivities, 605, 598, or 7. And 586. So from 597, say, to 486, you know, you got 110 years there. And by the time that he's exalted to the high place in Persia, he would be another at least 10 years. So it's not likely that we were talking about, it's not likely that it's talking about the who referring to Mordecai, but rather to his grandfather. Not a major point, but I did want to correct that because it was in the lesson and on the record. Thanks to Elizabeth for calling that to my attention. Nobody gets credit for correcting me about Mordecai being the uncle. I've done it too many times and had too many corrections, so y'all have to share that one. I was looking at some material that I'd been given over 30 years ago by a friend of mine, and he was a good Bible student, and it was interesting to me that he talked about Mordecai, her uncle. So anyway, misery loves company, right?
So it's not
done? Okay. We're in chapter 3, middle of chapter 3 here, and we had read in the first part of chapter 3, how Haman's wrath toward Mordecai was incensed because of his pride. He hated Mordecai. He wanted to destroy Mordecai. And so, beginning in verse 7, we're going to read about his plot to annihilate not just Mordecai, but the Jews. His pride, his anger is out of control. It'd be bad enough if he wanted to take it out against Mordecai, but he wants to destroy the whole Jewish population, the kingdom of Persia. So we start here in chapter 3 and verse 7 in the first month, which is the month Nisan, and that would be around March or April of our year, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus. Remember, we started in chapter 1, the third year of King Ahasuerus, which would be about 483, and we're to the 12th year now, which would be about 474 B.C. Pur, that is, the lot was cast before Haman from day to day and from month to month until the 12th month, which is the month Adar. Not that it was cast for all those months, but this lot would have numbers on it and would keep cast and go through the months until a month was chosen. How did they do that? I do not know. Why did they do that? Possibly just luck, that they were doing it on the basis of luck. More likely having to do maybe with either astrology or an appeal to their gods. We do know the Jews actually used lots, and God would use them to render divine decisions. But we know those were true. And maybe it was a looking for an omen from one of their gods as to what month would be an appropriate month. It's interesting that you see here that we're in March or April when he's doing this. And verse 12 says the king's scribe was summoned the 13th day of the first month. And this decree was written. But you see that the day of the annihilation was in verse 13 until the 13th day of the 12th month. What if the lot had been on the first month or the second month? Don't know, but would these intervening events have taken place. And throughout the story of Esther, you just see things that happened that had that not happened just that way, the whole story would have been changed. Why did it just happen that there was 11 months between the time they cast the lot, the decree was made, and the actual event that would destroy the Jews? But that did allow these other things to happen, and certainly all of this may be by the providence of God. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There's a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of all other people, and they do not observe the king's laws." Is that true? No, they're misrepresenting them. There may be some religious laws they didn't observe, but there was nothing they were doing to threaten the king. Of course, this is what was charged against Daniel. This is what was charged against Jesus. And so Haman, while pretending to be acting in the interest of the king, is actually acting in his own personal interest. So it is not the king's interest to let them remain. If it be pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed. And we read this, we read it casually, but think of the mindset that would even contemplate destroying, I don't know how many thousands and thousands of people. Not because God did that, but God is God, and he did it for a reason after years of patience. Because people were idolaters. That's not this at all. It's purely out of personal pride and anger. And he's willing to wipe out men, women, and children by the thousands. He said, "I'll pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business to put it into the king's treasury," which seems to be the royal treasuries. You remember, we talked about it in a previous class, that when you read about that banquet in chapter 1, this may well have been the kind of people he had together. He was planning this war on Greece. Remember, that was 483. And he did go to war against Greece, but finally the Persians were defeated in 479. So that's been about 5 years ago. We're at 474. And so what happens in war to the treasuries? What happened in the United States Treasury with the Gulf War? Sure, it's just a lot of money involved in war. And we don't know for sure, but maybe this is one of the appeals that Haman used that would certainly appeal to the king. He said, "I'll put this into the king's treasuries." Then the king took a signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. The king said to Haman, "The silver is yours," now note, "and the people also, to do with them as you please." And so you'll note at the end of verse 13, they were given the right to seize their possessions as plunder. And so they were going to not only kill the Jews, but take all of their possessions and their money. And when you look at this 10,000 talents of silver, I tried to reach some kind of a calculation on this. Not sure if I'm anywhere close. I found various sites that would try to give a weight of a talent anywhere from 75 to 100 pounds. I just used 91 pounds. And figuring it at the rate of silver today per ounce for 10,000 talents, if I calculated it right, be around $289 million. And I may be off, but it's a lot of money, a lot of money. And one source said Haman is offering the king a bribe equal to 2/3 of the royal income. If that's right, that's a lot of money. But what that also says is that if that's the case, and if a lot of this was going to come from the Jews, this tells you something about their position. Even though they're under the Persian Empire, they still have riches. And this is going to be used by Haman to satisfy his rage. The king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and it was written just as Haman commanded to the king's satraps, to the governors who were over each province, and to the princes of each people, each province according to its script, each people according to its language, being written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, to seize their possessions as plunder. A copy of the edict to be issued as law in every province was published to all the people so that they should be ready for this day. The couriers went out, impelled by the king's command, and they apparently had quite a, what we would call a postal system set up in Persia. The couriers went out, impelled by the king's command, while the decree was issued at the citadel of Susa. And while the king, now this is interesting, this last phrase in verse 15. Haman has just came out with a decree to annihilate thousands of people. The king has said, yeah, go ahead and do it. I'll take the money, and he said, here, I'll put the money in the king's treasury. What did they do? They sat down to eat and drink. What happens to people's hearts, to people's consciences? But you'll note the rest of the verse says the city of Susa was in confusion. We don't have enough. Yes, Sally?
I don't understand. This king is a nut. I do think he's a little nutty. Haman tells him that these people do these bad things. He doesn't even check it out.
No.
He just says, sure, go ahead. Yeah. Help yourself.
Yeah.
I don't get that.
Well, look at our present politics. Sometimes presidents, things are going on, and then when you ask them about it, oh, I don't know. And I don't know if they're lying or they don't know. But they act like they don't know what's going on. So I don't know. But yeah, that's a good point that Sally brings up. Why don't he investigate it? Of course, these guys weren't interested in justice. They were interested in power. They were interested in pride. They were interested in themselves. And I think this is what's called in the New Testament lording it over. Because Jesus told the apostles that you'll not rule like the Gentiles who lord it over. There's nothing wrong with authority. It's when people use authority for personal reasons and not for the good of the government. Governed. And that's what you see in King Xerxes or Ahasuerus. But the last statement says the city of Susa was in confusion. Try to envision if you're a Jew. You've been under Persian dominion since 539 when Cyrus conquered Babylon. There's Jews in the provinces. There's Jews that are now in Persia. But they have not been a problem people. It's not like they've incited rebellion against the king. Evidently, they've paid taxes. Why all of a sudden do they want to kill us? You can see how that would be perplexing. Why is this going on? I don't know if that what it's talking about. The city of Susa was in confusion. Maybe the perplexity is, what are we going to do? And it could well be that the city in confusion may have referred to the inhabitants in the city who were Persian citizens. Imagine if your neighbor was a Jew. You had a business and your customers were Jews. You bought from a merchant who was a Jew. All of a sudden, we're going to kill him? Why? You can see the perplexity. But you know, sometimes we're perplexed at the laws that are made as well. But anyway, it said it's the state of things at that time. And if we leave the story at this point, of course, it affects the rest of biblical history. But, of course, that's not the end of the story. We have said that had this lot fell on the, say, second month, or maybe some, I don't know if it not only had month, but if there's some way they determined the date other than maybe the day they were casting the lot. If it was sooner, chapter 4, chapter 5, chapter 6. No time, no place for these things. And so the fact that there's 11 months intervening allows for these events to take place. So when Mordecai learned all that had been done, chapter 4, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the midst of the city and wailed loudly and bitterly. He went and I looked up this word wailed, and I guess that's what it meant. I don't know what kind of noises these Jews made, but evidently it was a vocal thing. He went as far as the king's gate, which was evidently an entrance to the king's palace, and evidently there was a city square out in front of that. No one was to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. And this may be why you read what you do in verse 4, that she sent garments to clothe Mordecai, that he might remove his sackcloth from him, but he did not accept them. It may be that she sent the clothes so that he would have the privilege of coming in through the gate, talking to her and explaining why he is lamenting so much. What's going on? She didn't know. But nevertheless, verse 3, in each and every province where the command and decree of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, weeping, and wailing, and many lay on sackcloth and ashes. Then Esther's maidens and her eunuchs came and told her, and the queen writhed in great anguish, even though she didn't know why they were doing that. That was her people. And so she sent garments for Mordecai, but he wouldn't wear them. Verse 5, then Esther summoned Hathach from the king's eunuchs, whom the king had appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was. So Hathach went out to Mordecai to the city square in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him all that had happened to him. This is interesting in verse 7, and the exact amount of the money that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict, which had been issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show Esther and inform her and to order her to go into the king to implore his favor and to plead with him for her people. Hathach came back and related Mordecai's words to Esther. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and ordered him to reply to Mordecai. And when you get to this point, there are some things to consider. You're going to see her hesitancy. First of all, when you see her hesitancy, as we start to read here, Mordecai says, go to the king and implore about this thing. But what was the law about a king, a law that the king had put his signet ring in the Medes and the Persians? There's no changing. What am I going to say? Yeah, that's another thing. We'll get to that in a minute. But just the law itself. This is not a law that you override. This is not a law you say, oh, well, we made a mistake. They made that law. It can't be changed. All right, that's the first thing. And then, back in the first part of chapter 3, what had the king done with Haman? Elevated him to high position. So now I'm going to go to the king about this decree that somebody he's just promoted apparently thinks much of, and I'm going to implore the king against this guy. What are my chances of that? But then the third thing is the thing Ennis talked about, and that's what she began to talk about here. So, verse 11, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman, so forget the other thing, just to get to the king, there's another issue. For any man or woman who comes to the king to the inner court who is not summoned, he has but one law, that he be put to death, unless the king holds out to him the golden scepter that he may live. When I read the story of Esther and I think of these kings, they were powerful, they were rich, they were proud. You saw the banquets that you read about, 6 month banquet, chapter 1. Far, far and above that, is the King of heaven and earth. As the book of Psalms says, he owns the cattle on a thousand hills. He doesn't need anything. He's the majestic creator of the universe. He's the controller of nations, the creator of man. What if coming to God was this way? That you trembled whether or not he'd even receive you. Strike you dead if you called his name when he didn't ask you to come. What a difference in the King we serve and this King. Much more powerful, much more glorious, but also very merciful. We sing a song, Merciful and Mighty. Holy, holy, holy. Merciful and mighty. And I think of the King we serve in contrast to this King and how grateful we ought to be that he will receive us. He wants us to come. But she said, I have not been summoned to come to the king for these 30 days. They related Esther's words to Mordecai. And Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. And you and your father's house will perish. Now, on what basis did he make that statement? I don't know of anything that indicates Mordecai is a prophet. If he believed that, maybe it's because he believed in God's covenants. And he believed in the faithfulness of God's covenants. Maybe because he knew the story of Joseph. Maybe because he knew the story of Daniel. Maybe because of these other Old Testament events that showed that God will keep his covenant. And he just believed that if God promised that through the Jews the Messiah would come, God was going to make a way. I don't know what the basis of his statement is. But if indeed it's on that basis, you see this great man, this man's great faith in the spite of what looks like insurmountable odds. He can't explain how, but he said deliverance will arise for the Jews. But then this remarkable statement, at least to me, at the end of verse 14, something every one of us in this class tonight ought to think about. We've got young people like Emily over here. We've got people who are up in years. You may think, what use am I? Think of that statement in that verse. Whether you're young and your life's ahead of you, whether you're middle-aged, busy with your family, whether you're older and you think, well, my time is largely past or you're suffering, think of that statement. Who knows whether you have not attained, of course in our case it wouldn't be royalty, the state in life that you are, the things you've faced, the opportunities ahead of you for such a time as this. We could spend the rest of our class giving testimonials, but that's not what we're here for. But I know I can talk about things in our lives where events we can't explain just so happened to open doors to people that we could teach and became Christians. You can probably tell the same kind of thing. Maybe because you moved at a certain time or a certain place or some certain event happened. Who knows? Just keep your eyes and ears open and look for those opportunities to glorify God wherever you are. And Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go, assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. Now you know that the Hebrews, when they used that term 3 days, night and day, it was not literally 72 hours. They counted a part of a day for a day. You'll see when you get to chapter 5 and verse 1 on the third day, she approached the king. So if the events in chapter 4 were, say, in the afternoon, and if the events in chapter 5 were, say, in the forenoon, before noon, we're talking about one full day and two maybe parts of days. Instead of 72 hours, you know, maybe 45 hours or something. We don't know. But the point is, be aware of how they use these terms. That becomes very valuable when you talk about Jesus Christ being in the tomb 3 days and three nights. And there are some who say, well, you see, it wasn't full 3 days and full three nights. No. And there are idioms. It did not need to be. And so this is just a valuable thing to observe as we're going through the book that can be useful in our Bible study and other places. And she said, thus I will go into the king, which is not according to the law. And then there's this statement. If I perish, I perish. In other words, there's something greater than my well-being at stake here. I'm reminded of the apostle over in the 20th chapter of the book of Acts. Verse 24, he's talking to the elders of the church at Ephesus. I do not consider my life of any account as dear to myself. Was Paul depressed? Was he thinking about suicide? No, that's not the point. It's in comparison to, look, so that I may finish my course and the ministry which I received from the Lord Jesus to testify solemnly the gospel of the grace of God. He knows that ahead of him, verse 23, bonds and afflictions await. He's been told that. But he said, so be it. I've got a job to do. And if I must go to prison, I'll go to prison. Whatever it takes to do my work. And so in chapter 21, verse 12, they beg him not to go to Jerusalem. Paul answered, what are you doing, weeping and breaking my heart, for I'm ready not only to be bound, but even to die at Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus. What an attitude. That I've got a job God's given me to do. It's bigger than me. If I die, okay. And so that's her attitude here. So Mordecai went away and did just as Esther had commanded him. Any comments on chapter 4 before we go to chapter 5? All right, chapter 5. First part of the chapter is about what?
Esther goes before the king.
What? Esther goes before the king. Esther goes before the king, and she's received, isn't she? She received favorably. And then the second part of the chapter, beginning in verse 4, is about what? Her banquet, her first banquet. And then verse 9 of chapter 5 is about what? Beginning to the end. That's right. Haman plans to hang Mordecai, to kill Mordecai. We'll see as we study chapter 5 that the events in the first part of the chapter opens the door for the events in the last part of the chapter. And the events in chapter 6 that become critical to this whole story. So it came about on the third day, verse 1 of chapter 5, that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's rooms. And the king was sitting on his royal throne in the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. She knew that when she stood before the king, everything turned on whether or not he saw her favorably. And so she dressed for the occasion. Could she have said the same thing in her everyday clothes? Certainly. Did she put on these royal robes for her benefit?
No.
No. She was aware that appearance has an impact on other people. And she employed that on this occasion. She was willing to go through whatever efforts, trouble, whatever you want to call it, to try to appeal to the king, and this involved, in this case, appearance. Hold your finger here and go to Matthew chapter 22, verse 11. Look at Matthew chapter 22 and verse 11. It's interesting as we study the Old Testament book, practical things we can pick up about us, about people. Here's a story Jesus is telling about a king who gave a wedding feast for his son, verse 2. So he's a king, a man of royalty, and this is a wedding feast for his son. And you get to verse 11, the king came in to look over the dinner guest and saw a man there who was not dressed in wedding clothes. What difference does it make? You know, sometimes today I go to weddings, little as possible, but I go to weddings. And there are people that come in and they're dressed like they just got off the farm or something, or baling hay or playing with the dogs. You go to funerals and you see the same thing. Now, what kind of clothes they wear doesn't change their love for the couple necessarily, or their expression of comfort for the deceased, that they're concerned about that person. But what about people, particularly family, who sees them come in that way? Maybe they think nothing about it. Maybe they're the same kind of people. I don't know. In this case, it made a difference. This king looked and saw how this fellow was dressed, and he felt like it was an affront to the king, failure of respect. And so he said, verse 12, "Friend, how did you come in here without wedding clothes?" And the man was speechless. Of course, Jesus is not talking about clothes. It's a lesson about the kingdom of heaven, regard for it. But he uses something from everyday life that we understand. We see from Esther that clothes or appearance can affect people favorably. We see from Matthew 22:11, they understood in another royal setting where clothes can be disfavor. You remember back in 1 Samuel 16, when a king was going to be chosen after God said Saul told Saul that the throne would be taken from him. And so you remember how these boys started coming before Samuel. And you remember the oldest son, why Samuel thought this is the one?
The way he looked.
God said, no, that's not the one. And here comes this boy with a ruddy face, young. He said, he's the one. And then there's a statement made you can probably quote. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. The point is, the Lord looks on the heart. That's the point. But incidental truth is truth nonetheless. Man does look on the outward appearance. That's a fact. Are there applications to this every day? I think so. I know the Apostle Paul, and you don't have to turn over there, 1 Corinthians 9, you remember what Paul said to the Jews, I became a Jew that I might gain the Jews? Remember that? To the Gentiles? In other words, he adapted to circumstances that would benefit him in his work in the gospel. Let's take the Lord's Supper. When you wait on the table, you can think the same thing and be just as reverent in flip-flops and a shirt that's got print on it as you can in a suit and tie. But the question is, all these people that are sitting out here in the audience, does it impact them? Some it won't. I assure you that some it will. It will. So not for your benefit, but recognizing this principle the Bible teaches that appearance impacts people. Wouldn't I do that which will best benefit worshiping God and those who are trying to worship God? You can apply it to the husband-wife relationship. You know, when people are courting, the woman tries to dress up, fix her hair like he likes, and wear the pretty clothes, and maybe, hopefully he shaves and tries to not smell bad at least. And if he doesn't, she loves him anyway. Well, then she's getting what she bargained for, I guess. But then when they get married, what happens? Oh, we're married now. When that guy comes home at the end of the day, what's the first thing he sees? Yeah, what does he see when he sees her? You know? He say, you know, I should have stayed at work a little longer. What did he see? And vice versa with the man. Maybe it's Saturday morning and they're going to spend the day together. What does he look like? So, oh, it doesn't make any difference to me. No, it may not. And maybe it doesn't make any difference to your mate. I don't know. But what I do know is there's a principle here that appearance. We are people and people look on the outward appearance. I do know that. Anyway, kind of a tangent, but I thought an interesting tangent as we talked about Esther here. And she's this very critical point in these events that she recognized how she dressed may affect the outcome of her purpose. When the king saw Esther the queen standing in the court, she obtained favor in his sight. The king extended to Esther the golden scepter, which was in his hand. You know, if this was a movie, they probably have movies about Esther, I don't know. You can imagine what would happen. She would stand there, and of course they would have a pause, you know. You'd wait for the, well, what's he going to do? I don't know how long there was when he first saw her, and there she was in her grace and beauty, but he extended the scepter. And Esther came near and touched the top of the scepter, and the king said to her, "What's troubling you, Queen Esther, and what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom it shall be given to you." Again, this is not literal. This was an idiomatic way, a hyperbole, an exaggeration, to say, I'm going to give you I love you, I care about you, or whatever the case may be. In this case it was, his queen. I'll grant a tremendous request. A way to emphasize that. You remember King Herod did the same thing about the woman who danced. Even the half of my kingdom I'll give you. Not literally, but you know, you're in my favor. You ask what you want and I'll grant it. Most everybody in this room remembers the movie in 1946. I'm not saying you were living then. You've just seen it. You see it every year. You'll see it again this year, probably. A Wonderful Life. You remember how Mr. Bailey said, George Bailey said to Mary, "Why, what do you want? The moon? I'll get you the moon. I'll just lasso it and get you the moon." It's a great part of that movie. But well, he wasn't saying that literally. He just saying, "Mary, I'll do anything for you. I'm intended to be rich." That's what his intentions were. "And I'll take care of you." Well, that's what this is. "I'll give you half of my kingdom. Just tell me what's on your mind." So we need to understand those figures of speech as we read through. And so Esther said, "If it pleases the king, may the king and Haman come this day to the banquet that I have prepared for him." Then the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, that we may do as Esther desires." So the king and Haman came to the banquet which Esther had prepared. As they drank wine at the banquet, the king said to Esther, "What is your petition? For it shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom it shall be done." So Esther replied, "My petition and my request is." And here's my question. I don't have an answer. Maybe you can answer it. Why didn't she tell him then? Why did she hesitate? Why did she say, "Well, let's have a second banquet"? I do not know the answer to that. Did she hesitate out of fear? Did she have some other reason for hesitating? Maybe she thought there'd be a more appropriate time. I do not know. But I'll tell you what's interesting. Between this banquet and the second banquet, you have Haman so overjoyed that he's been asked to a banquet with the king and the queen. He's so full of pride. He says, "I hate Mordecai, I'll build a gallows and hang him." The very gallows he would be hanged on. And between the first banquet and the second banquet, chapter 6, the king couldn't sleep. And because the king couldn't sleep, he found out about Mordecai saving his life. And Mordecai is elevated. Now we have the second banquet. I don't know that Esther knew any of that would happen. I don't know why she hesitated. Was God's hand in this somehow? I do not know the answer. Do you?
Perhaps she wanted to wine and dine.
Huh?
Perhaps she wanted to, in essence, wine and dine the king, that he would be more receptive because she's going to make such a large request.
Could be. Of course, she's whining and dining him now. Maybe she thought a second dose would do good. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe you're right. You might be right, Lil. Maybe she thought, hey, wait a man's heart is through his stomach, I'll feed him twice. I do not know. But it is interesting about the turn of events, isn't it?
She gave him something so he couldn't sleep.
Huh? You think she put something in there so he couldn't sleep? We could read that in. We could put that in the movie, couldn't we? So she said, if I found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and do what I request, may the king and Haman come to the banquet, which I'll prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king says. And, you know, somebody said a while ago, why don't the king know what's going on? And what, Haman, why don't you think about it? Does the king even raise a question as, why didn't she tell me today? I don't know. So in 9 through the end of the chapter, we're about out of time, but we'll look at that real quickly, and then we'll start chapter 6 on our next class. So Haman, again, verse 9, Mordecai won't bow to him. He's filled with anger. We've read the verses. Pride goes before a fall. Anger causes a man to do foolish things. Boy, that is so true here. So true. And so he went to his house and sent for his friends and his wife, Zeresh, verse 10. And note the pride. He recounted to them the glory of his riches, number one. He's a rich, rich man. The number of his sons, chapter 9 says he got 10 sons. And every instance where the king had magnified him and promoted him. Shouldn't this man be happy? Things, riches. That kind of does not necessarily make people happy, folks. Even sometimes large families doesn't make people happy. This guy wasn't satisfied. His pride was wounded. And so he realized he's invited to eat with the king and queen again. And so Zeresh, his wife, verse 14, said, have some gallows 50 cubits high. Why so high? That's tall. Maybe. Hey, everybody will see. Everybody will learn a lesson from this. I do not know. And so here they are, friends and family, having a good time together, doing evil. Doing evil. Isn't that sad? And so he had the gallows made. We'll stop there, beginning chapter 6, the Lord willing, in our class.